Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Climate change is a global problem, and we're hearing about activism that's seeking large-scale change. One of the most public impacts in central New York might be Skaneateles Lake. Changes to the lake being tied to climate change could threaten the lake as a drinking water source and as a popular tourist and recreation destination.
Warmer temperatures are having an impact. We saw our first reported algal bloom. It was lake-wide in 2017. That was also the year the city of Syracuse noted the lake in September was 75 degrees, which was a record high.
Skaneateles's Lake Association president, Frank Moses, has every reason to get people interested and more active. The Lake Association joined the masterclass at St. James Church and Sustainable Skaneateles to host a forum on climate change impacts and actions. WAER's Chris Bolt was there to moderate the discussion.
Local residents gathered to hear academic, planning, and energy experts from a variety of backgrounds make some links to climate change and why they should be concerned about it. Perhaps more importantly, the conversation turned to what people could and should do. Before people are going to act, they need to see the reasons. Syracuse University's Dr. Charlie Driscoll has studied changing climate and the natural environment.
We've been experiencing increases in temperature, particularly in the summer and the winter. We see increases in precipitation, but with fewer, more intense events. We see decreases in snowpack. We see more variable weather and extreme events.
Another professor, Dr. Brian Ledet from SUNY ESF, comes at it from a different perspective, rising worries about disease.
I hear about everybody says, I didn't worry about it 10 years ago, but now you can't go out there without a tick climbing on you. Why is that? Global climate change. So the environment is ripe for the tick to get through its biological cycle. Ticks are increasing in numbers. They're bringing along disease. So when people ask me about climate change, again, I can't show them CO2 in the air. It's very hard. I don't even quite understand that processes. But I can go in their backyard and collect 20 ticks, and half of them are infected with a disease.
And while CNY is not going to be inundated with sea level rise, SUNY Cortland geology professor Dr. David Barkley says it may well have impacts here.
And you're probably thinking that, well, wait a minute, we're way above sea level up here. We're just fine. Well, no. If New York City takes a hit, we help pay for it. When there's a $1 billion disaster in Houston, we help pay for it. And when the National Flood Insurance Program finally croaks because it's underfunded, we'll have to deal with that because we won't have money for our local flooding issues.
Another type of local impact has been on the change in policy, such as the state's efforts to increase green energy production. Chris Gorman of National Grid places the utility squarely in the column of that kind of change.
You outlined an 80 by 50 pathway, which calls for 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050, with some intermediate goals by 2030. And we look forward to being a leader in this area.
Solar and wind is becoming more affordable and more cost competitive. But there was also a report from the International Energy Agency this week saying we're not moving nearly fast enough.
Chris Carrick runs energy programs at the CNY Regional Planning and Development Board. He sees some good news amid the challenges.
And when folks ask me what gives you hope, it's the Sunrise Movement. It's Extinction Rebellion. It's young folks and others who are speaking up with moral clarity.
Both Ledet at ESF and Barkley at Cortland see student involvement as important and have ideas about how that youthful enthusiasm can be effective.
They're energized, they're forming clubs, sustainability clubs, they're pushing initiatives. At the same time, though, I think when you get a little too much about, you know, the climate crisis, they tend to shut down. Trying to keep it optimistic, trying to keep the possibilities of actually making a difference as an option.
And I teach students at ESF, and I don't have to tell them about climate change. I have to tell them how to communicate to people that don't believe or think about climate change. It's not through that tree or an ice sheet melting. It's through health. And if they can see it and tie it to their health, or maybe their rise in their AC bill, they're running their AC more. Well, that's because of this.
For others here in CNY, Carrick notes you should pay attention to what's fueling climate change, namely fuels, fossil fuels.
We drive a lot. And we drive pretty inefficient cars, big SUVs, and so forth. So, you know, one thing to do is to look at an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid. The second largest source is heating and cooling our buildings, and that's why we're involved with the Heat Smart CNY campaign.
Regardless of what laws are passed or what people do, a consensus among the scientists and other experts is urgency. Count SU's Charlie Driscoll among the alarmed.
But the big problem, as I see it, is the rate of change is unprecedented. We are changing carbon dioxide levels and other greenhouse gases at a very, very fast rate. And as a result, the weather is changing at a very fast rate. So we can adapt, we can mitigate, or we can ignore it.
And geologist Barkley, who studies climate from centuries and eons past, brings some good news from what history tells us.
For example, a lot of volcanic eruptions over the last 1,000 years produced the Little Ice Age, a slightly cooler than average interval. What that tells us is that if we start to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, the climate system will level off in terms of its warming and it will recover. And the simple lesson is the sooner we start to switch off our emissions, the sooner we can expect the climate system to level off to what we think of as a more normal kind of climate that we have right now.
Coming up, we'll have our roundtable discussion on ways to engage the community on the issues of climate change. This is Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
Digital content on WAER is supported by California Closets of Syracuse, creating custom storage solutions for all areas of the home, as well as in professional offices and commercial spaces. Learn more at californiaclosets.com or by visiting their DeWitt showroom.
Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Climate change can feel like a distant, heady topic, and while fully understanding the nuances of the science behind it can be complicated, its effects are very real, and it's impacting people globally and right here in our community. I'm joined today by WAER News Director Chris Bolt.
Here in central New York, people are seeing the effects of climate change. And while that might not be the drought, fires, and flooding due to sea level rise, there are heightened concerns about disease, farmers seeing some of their crops being no longer viable, and things such as algae blooms becoming more prevalent and fouling pristine waters. Some people are taking steps, such as an electric car or solar power on their homes. Others have joined activist groups and taken to the streets for policy change. But it remains to be seen how many will get engaged and what kinds of impacts they can have.
Today, we're joined by some guests who have experience in grounding the climate change discussion, using their expertise as a bridge to help better communicate the effects of climate change to the public. Joining us, we have Ken Harper, a professor of visual communications at Syracuse's Newhouse School, Renee Vogelsang, campaign strategist and climate activist, and Edward Morris with the Canary Project and transmedia professor at Syracuse University's College of Visual and Performing Arts. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
So my first question for all of you, just to open it up to the group, is what was the thing that got you to be involved in climate activism? What was the thing that made you say, I need to do something about this?
I'll go first. For me, it's a very definite moment. And I was living in New York. I was actually a private investigator. I'll take questions on that later. And I read a series of articles in The New Yorker by Elizabeth Colbert called The Climate of Man. And I don't know why these particular articles had an effect on me. I mean, climate change was roughly in the news at that time. But I think it was the viscerality of them and the fact that she went out and talked to scientists around the world about the changes they were seeing in real time. And about the discrepancy between their understanding of the issue and public understanding and therefore political will. And upon reading those articles, it's not an exaggeration to say I felt really outraged or sort of morally imperiled in some way. Mm-hmm. And it changed my life. So from that point on, I worked with my wife, Susanna, who I always work with, to start a project of visualizing climate change, of taking photographs around the world of landscapes being impacted by climate change, working with the same scientists that Betsy Colbert worked with in her article. So that kind of began the journey for me, and it was a very definite moment.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Elizabeth Colbert. Her Field Notes from a Disaster is sort of a seminal climate change book from 12 years ago now,
right,
that really was inspiring for a lot of people. Ken, how did you come to it?
Well, it's been a bit of an evolution, and I'm certainly late to the game compared to our other esteemed panelists here. I think when I really first started hearing, I was working in West Africa and Liberia, and we were leading a group of journalists on a training exercise, an area called Riverses. And the superintendent, who's basically the governor of the area, said, "Oh, we just moved the village." And I go, "Really? Why'd you move the village?" He said, "Well, you know, the ocean's coming in." And I'm like, he's like, "You know, climate change." And I went, "Wow, okay." And this is 2011. And I hadn't really considered it before. And like most people, we get busy with our lives and we get into our work and we move forward. And it was the first time it really was brought to my attention. And I just started paying attention a little bit more. And honestly, it's in the past year that I feel like it's come to a bit of a climax for me personally and really educating myself. And even in the past 3 to 6 months, trying to process all that, because it's all very heavy, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And really researching the science. And okay, now that I have a grasp of it on a basic level, what can I do about it? Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to begin that journey.
Yeah. And Renee, what about you?
Wow. So I got kind of the activist and social movement bug initially on all sorts of issues. But I would say probably the issue I felt most deeply about was environmental issues and environmental protection, and started doing that work in college. I went to college at SUNY Oswego, just north of here in Syracuse. And we had a really great activist movement there. When I was going to school, this is in the early 2000s. So, you know, just kind of powerful organizers, powerful student organizers, and was really interested in clean water, clean air, looking at the impacts of fossil fuels on that, and went forward actually to work on those issues following college. In field organizing, canvassing, knocking on doors, talking to people about coal and, you know, scrubbers and regulating fossil fuel emissions that way, and then working with a group called Clean Water Action on, you know, clean water and fossil fuel, the relationship between clean water and clean air and fossil fuel emissions. But really, you know, so for years I was really focused on water protection and air protection as opposed to climate, right? Mm-hmm. But as the years are going by, we're just getting more and more information about climate change, about global warming, about how serious the situation is. And, you know, it just takes kind of getting the statistics, getting the escalation of the problem, that really, you know, you start to pivot. It is about having clean water and clean air, and I think that that's still something we need to focus on as we work as climate and environmental activists. But there is, you know, a serious crisis emergency happening here. And I will say, actually, one of my personal aha moments, in addition to just the scientists and the overwhelming science and experts telling us where things are at, was just physically experiencing it. So I was in California in 2015. And I was, you know, at the top of a mountain attending a wedding ceremony, and we had to evacuate because a fire was coming really fast. Mm-hmm. And when you're praying and going down a mountain and see dark smoke billowing over the top of your head and the top of your car, I mean, I will definitely say it's kind of a really chilling moment. And as much as I was a climate activist already and doing that work and already kind of scared and anxious about it, it takes it to another level when you physically experience these wildfires and hurricanes and things like that that are going on and intensifying.
And so you all are engaging with this in a very unique sort of non-direct way, I would say. You're not just basically sitting someone down and looking at a poster board to engage with climate change. What have you found to be some of the benefits of engaging in these ways that mold with your own expertise?
Well, I think understanding climate change really requires two mental capacities. It requires cognitive understanding, some kind of knowledge about it, information-based learning. But it also requires some kind of emotional understanding. I think if you go into an exhibit, say at a science museum, and you come out of it saying, oh, yeah, I get climate change. I really understand it, but have no sense of urgency or even grief about it, then you actually don't understand it. You don't understand its urgency, and you're unlikely to be motivated to act about it. So, you know, it's somewhat of a cliche, but I think there's some truth to it, that art provides the emotional understanding of this issue, and that's what we seek to do.
Mm-hmm. I think there's an issue of cognitive dissonance, too. One of the things I discovered following after Trump was elected, honestly, is Professor George Lakoff of Berkeley and his writings on this concept that people, you know, if they're presented with information that runs contrary to their belief system or threatens the way they've been brought up in some way fundamentally, they won't even process the information.
Mm-hmm.
And to break through that kind of psychological reality, it's a whole different level of understanding how to craft a story and how to reach people. It has to be personal. It has to be something they can relate to. And that's a different way of telling stories than a lot of, you know, media organizations are used to producing, and has to do with our own communities. And I think there are hopeful things that are happening out in the world where people are really starting to dive into that. There's a project actually in Sweden where they have a whole city that's supposed to be carbon neutral by 2030, and one of the people they employ is a chief storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And that storyteller is all about, you know, working with people in their community to evolve the way they live their lives to be carbon neutral, and using story as a way to help shift people's attitudes and what they do in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really unique way of thinking about it. It's certainly a lot more micro than a lot of, especially like big box media organizations are used to producing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Renee?
Powerful.
I mean, what kinds of things have you done that you find are creative to increase that engagement, mm-hmm, instead of just being the pounding of the facts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really the storytelling piece is really powerful. I think that's a big part of it. You'll see there's a lot of films that are out there. That's a huge part of the climate movement. A lot of documentary films on getting off of fossil fuels, fracking, an issue I worked on for several years here in New York State. And I'm happy to see there's more films about the solutions coming out and obviously the seriousness of the climate crisis. So that's a way that I think people start to feel the level of severity and, you know, also just a lot of art and activism going on with... you know, even seeing stuff in feature films, so not just documentary films, but kind of art imitating life. We do a lot with music. We've done concerts, multimedia events, you know, featuring kind of the personal lives of people who are suffering from the impacts of climate change and working with people in the art and music community. So reaching people that way. There's, you know, a lot of different creative things going on. Even here in Syracuse, coming up in February, there's going to be an art show called Fire and Ice, featuring glaciers and wildfires. So, you know, these are with some educational events surrounding this art show. So there's, you know, a lot of different great things that people are doing. Banner drops, you know, creative protests, die-ins, sit-ins, you know, a lot of great artwork involved in protest. So a creative protest, not just marches and rallies, mm-hmm, per se, but really taking it to another level with just dropping in the middle of you know, New York City somewhere, or, you know, outside of a corporation's headquarters or an elected official's office, and having more creative forms of theater and artwork and puppetry and all of these different things that kind of showcase what's going on in regards to climate and what's at stake, what we're going to lose and what we can gain.
It's nothing short of a revolution is what we need.
Mm-hmm.
And people are not acting in proportion to what's happening. You know, if your house is on fire, you don't make a sandwich. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. And I think, you know, famously, Greta Thunberg, the climate activist, has really brought that seriousness home, you know, and having to put that weight on that generation that's going to inherit all the mess that we've created with our selflessness me included, you know, I drive an SUV.
And we let you. We let you on this panel.
I know, right?
We should have vetted that better.
Let me tell you, we also have a Prius.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit crazy like that. We can't wait to actually give the Highlander back. In all seriousness, I think there's a lot of people. Nobody's guiltless here.
Sure.
We're all a part of the world, and some of us are more conscious than others. And I think it has to almost hit home for folks.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I'm not so sure. I had a good friend I still do have a good friend who's more on the right wing of things. And I called him up after a big hurricane hit Houston. I said, Dan, are you okay? He's like, yeah, man, I'm good. And we're video chatting. So he walks outside and the floodwaters are literally halfway up his driveway. I'm like, yo, man, you should really get out of there. It looks dangerous. It sounds horrible down there. He's like, no. You know, I got a Jeep. I'll be okay. I'm not too worried about it. So I wait a little bit. I'm like, so has this made you reconsider the climate crisis at all? And he's like, no, I'm against pollution, you know, but I don't want to hurt our economy. And then he literally turns the camera and shows me his giant gun collection.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I grew up with Dan. And I think most of us have friends that see things differently, or family members and so on. And trying to have these conversations in a human, respectful way, but not let that get in the way of the seriousness and the urgency of it.
We've been talking about how we can discuss climate change in ways that might be relatable to people and make them move to action. Coming up, we'll discuss with our panel the importance of getting young people involved and who we may be ignoring in the conversation. This is Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
The people who are already marginalized, the communities who are already experiencing a lot of oppression that has been structural for generations, stand to continue to be further marginalized and further oppressed and experience the most extreme climate violence as a result of our inaction.
At WAER, trust is at the center of what we do. You trust that we'll take the time to diligently research the facts in order to deliver the most balanced and comprehensive coverage possible. You trust that we won't ignore or overlook issues because they're difficult. And in return, we trust that when the time comes to help support the future of WAER, that we'll hear from you. Why wait? You can do your part now by visiting WAER.org and clicking the red donate button at the top of the page.
The real escalation of these natural disasters has been really serious, like, Hurricane Maria and its effect on Puerto Rico, what happened in Houston, and it's just going to keep getting worse. And, like, if that's happening in the United States, it's so much worse on other people in other countries.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Zolkowski. We're discussing how to get people engaged and energized around the issue of climate change. There's been a fair amount of attention given to some youth movements, such as activism of Greta Thunberg and the recent climate strike. Joining us to talk about the future of the movement and getting people involved are Ed Morris with the Canary Project and transmedia professor at Syracuse University's College of Visual and Performing Arts, Ken Harper, a professor of visual communications at Syracuse's Newhouse School, Renee Vogelsang, campaign strategist and climate activist, and joining us for this segment is Oren Lyons, Onondaga faithkeeper and Indigenous rights activist. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
So what I want to ask you guys in regards to the future of this movement and youth involvement is there an age that is too young to start talking about climate change? Is there a certain way we should talk to kids about climate change and this issue that might be a little bit different than how we speak to our peers?
I would say no. I don't think there is an age that's too young. Of course, there are different ways to talk to children of different ages about this issue. And of course, I think it's up to parents and also their teachers. But we're seeing a movement in Europe right now around climate change being a part of curriculum from the get-go. And I think that's something we should do here in the United States as well. I think that children have kind of this raw, pure connection to nature and to the planet and to the water and the air and the animals. And I think it's just a great opportunity to turn things around for our future, to have children learning about keeping our water clean, keeping our air clean, keeping our climate safe and healthy. And, you know, as they get older, being able to maybe get into that a little bit deeper. But there's a lot of creative ways. There's children's books that can talk about the environment. There's even, you know, children's media, I think, that can touch on this, and some are, you know, at some levels a little bit. I would love to see more. I have ideas for media for children. So, I would say I think that it's really exciting, especially to see the youth movement right now. A lot of middle school and high school, even elementary school kids who are a part of the youth strikes around the world and here in the U.S.
So I'm an artist, I'm an activist, I'm also a dad, right. And I have an 8-year-old, and it is definitely never too early to talk to your kid about climate change, because beyond having a feeling for nature, as you expressed, Renee, they have a feeling for justice, and it feels deeply unjust to them. And so, yeah, I think you have to figure out ways to talk to them. But in one, as you were saying, Renee, I think one of the single most effective things we could do for fomenting climate action is to make it a required part of a curriculum at a very early age. And you can step through it in a non-alarmist way, a non-scary way. And that's the biggest thing you could do, I think.
Yeah, my kids actually, we live in Casanova, and my daughter was part of the climate strike that one Friday. And she stood out there with like 4 or 5 other folks in front of the middle school and, you know, is trying to raise awareness and doing what you can do. I think that's really important. You can't pull punches with kids. They don't, first of all, they don't appreciate it. They know a lot more than we're giving them credit for, just like we did when we were younger, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a tough world. We have to be honest about what's happening. You approach it with kindness and thoughtfulness about who your individual child might be, but it's important to be honest. I think, you know, when Greta Thunberg was talking about how dare you steal our future, you know, she was mad, and she should be mad. And that's the kind of proportional response that we need. That's the kind of energy we need to be able to combat what's happened and what we've done to the planet, what we've done to ourselves, and maybe more importantly, what we've done to future generations.
In maybe an unvarnished way that a young person can do, as opposed to, you know, someone who's part of a group and has a lot of other considerations.
Yeah. They're growing up in doing gun safety drills and, you know, active shooters. And, you know, my daughter's type 1 diabetic. And so every room that she has, this made me mad, every room that she goes into, she has to have a diabetic lockbox for when the active shooter happens, she can be locked in her room and not die from some diabetic issue.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Every room. So every semester, we have to change that out. And I went, I won't say what I'm thinking, but it was rough. I mean, it infuriates me. And the things they have to deal with every day, we need to be honest about it. They can handle it. They just need to be guided and loved and walked through a few things, but we're in it together, and they're going to inherit it.
Yeah. Oren Lyons, part of your philosophy and teachings are connection to the earth, past and future. How are you putting into what some might have just a small taste of Native American philosophy around the earth and protecting it? How does climate change fit into that? How are you talking with that among your youth and, you know, the people who will be our, you know, future inhabitants and leaders in the world we're leaving for them?
Well, the Onondaga Nation's central fire of the Haudenosaunee people French call us Iroquois, and the English call us Six Nations, and our proper name is Haudenosaunee. The Onondaga Nation of Central Fire have been here for a long time. And in 1799, one of our leaders, a Seneca chief by the name of Gunyundayo, was taken on a spiritual journey. And I was instructed in that spiritual journey that his brothers from across the water brought a lot of things on his ships, and these spiritual beings said, we did not give you enough information, so you're here to receive last instructions. And this was in 1799. And they gave him these instructions, and they also said, well, since you're here, we're going to show you the future. And they showed him the future. A lot of things that they showed him has come to pass. Some have not yet. But the ending is not good. And that's what I'm saying. It's not good. And it was frightening to him, disturbing. And he said, well, this is the end. They said, this is where it's going to end. He said, well, if that's the case, what's the use? And they said, you tell your people, your families, your friends, your leaders, that the generation that allows this to happen is going to suffer beyond all comprehension. And you tell your people, and your friends, and your family, don't let it be your generation. In other words, the fate of what's going to happen is in our hands. We're the ones responsible. It's not going to come from anywhere out of space. It's here, and it's really up to us to do that. Nothing complicated about that, but behavior, you know, behavior at the levels of corporate responsibility, I would say corporate irresponsibility at this point is where we're at. And the consequence of that is what we're facing here. We're facing a crisis that has a number on the end of it now. There's a report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN, and followed very closely with the U.S. Global Climate Headquarters. They said the same thing. Got about 12 years. 12 years at point of no return. Now, point of no return is exactly what it says. That once you pass that, there's nothing you can do to change it. That's where you're at. We are at. All that. Right now. So you don't have a lot of time. You know, I was listening to your discussion about the children, and of course, our philosophy of seven generations is, you know, directed to the responsibility of the current generation to behave correctly and look after their welfare unto seven generations, and that's the 80-year generation. It's not the shortcut that people like to take all the time. So the responsibility is here, right now, in our hands, and it's ultimately crisis serious. You don't have time. You don't have time.
Now, as we advance this conversation around climate change, I mean, voices are going to be left out when there are more voices in the field. And communities of color have traditionally been left out of these conversations while also bearing a lot of the effects that climate has on their environments. So what can we do now as we become more aware and more educated in the climate realm to lift those voices? And are we ignoring anyone at this point in the climate conversation?
I think it's important to recognize that some folks are using this as an excuse to further their own evil intentions. Ecofascism is on the rise, and several of the recent mass shooters, like in New Zealand and in El Paso, credited, they talked about ecology. They talked about the climate crisis. They were using this as, you know, we can't handle more people, and we need to get rid of some of the folks that aren't like us. I think recognizing that these issues bleed together, and some of these groups are using these things, it's just the idea of climate justice, not only the justice for future generations, but for those folks that are most at risk, you know, in the global south, right? All those folks that are just more vulnerable to these things. But you go down to Miami, I have a student down in Miami who was a broadcaster there. And she's like, it's not a political debate here. Mm-hmm. It's not a Republican thing. It's not a Democrat thing. Everybody's getting flooded. And it's very serious.
Right.
And they've turned the corner. Now, I don't know if that has to happen to everybody. It certainly concerns me. And I'm worried about incremental change. I think it's more like revolution level change where systems have to be shut down. So I'm a big fan of Extinction Rebellion and a lot of their methods. I think it's going to take a lot of voices and a lot of methods, but I don't see slow change working out. It is not going to work out for us.
Well, you have to do something more quickly, more effective. 2000, that's 19 years ago, I gave a speech on climate at the United Nations. 2000, that's 19 years ago. I said the ice is melting. And we had received that information from the native people from Greenland. They had come to us and said, we've got to do something. It is going. And so we made this statement. And it had such an impact that they asked me to give the same statement at the end of the event as well. The first time they ever did the same statement twice. But they were all affected by it. And so 2000, we said this is very urgent, all right? So I was over time to our 2014, they said, Chief Lyons, will you address the General Assembly again on issues? And I said, yeah, sure. And the issues, of course, is climate and one of it. And so I said, well, I'll start writing. And I said, well, why should I write? I gave this speech. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened. So I gave the very same speech that I did. This is 14 years later, and they were all wisely agreeing and shaking their heads and agreeing with what I was saying. Then I said, this is what I said 14 years ago. Situation is worse today. Or it caught them, 10 feet off first base. But it was shocking. That's 2014. Right, nothing done, gotten worse. All right, so obviously lip service is cheap, fast, and ineffective, and so action has to be taken, has been taken, grassroots. The people that I talk with, the grassroots, are discouraged because of the lack of support of their position. They're tired. They're ground troops on the ground. They're fighting hard. And they said, nobody wants to hear it. It's very frightening to begin with, of course, but the reality is there. Now, in relation to that, it's industry. It's corporations. They're the culprit. It's the extraction companies. It's the drilling. They're the ones that really are in charge, and they're rampant. So considering all of that, here's a statement. This is February of this year. And it says, much needed pipelines are on tap for the booming U.S. oil and gas industry. It's 2015. This is this year. Where everybody's recycling. These guys are putting in pipelines. Got to move faster. It's too slow. Trains are too slow. Right here. This year. And so, in other words, good people are trekking hard on the ground. The ones who are in charge pay no attention.
I think there's some changes happening. The European Investment Bank just recently, they're the largest public bank in the world, is going to stop lending for fossil fuel projects. That's very recent news, and that gives me a little bit of hope. But enough to get up in the morning and continue the fight, basically.
Oh, it's not over. It's not over. I mean, people have to understand that. I look at this. I used to be a boxer. I used to fight, this is a championship fight. You're in the 15th round. You're in the championship round, and it's even. It's even. I can beat him.
Except that it's not a boxing match, and the 15th bell will ring, and we'll. The Earth will still be here. And so for me, it's really, even if we don't have a chance, and I think if you're really honest with yourself, as you're saying we should be, we don't have much of a chance.
Stop.
But even if you don't, you do the same things anyway. And you do it out of a sense of responsibility. And one of the things I like about Extinction Rebellion as well is that their first goal seems like a very simple one, but it's a very important one, which is just to say it's an emergency. Just to declare it's an emergency, a national emergency, international emergency, and then that becomes a bipartisan issue. It is an emergency.
It is. Absolutely.
It is an emergency and a crisis. And, you know, and I agree with Oren that I think that, you know, we need to see that it's a crisis and an emergency, but that we also have a chance. We have an ability, if we move very quickly, to turn things around. Move quicker than we've ever had to move before. And those of us, you know, who are working in the activist and organizing community are working really hard at that. And just to speak to, you know, the question before about who might we be leaving out of this conversation, you know, I think frontline communities, folks who are impacted by the pipelines and by the extraction and drilling, people who are facing these stronger, more powerful, frequent hurricanes, wildfires that are, you know, raging across California right now, folks who are feeling the pollution, the sea levels rise, who will be displaced, all these, you know, displaced by drought, all these climate refugees who are going to be moving across the United States. You know, that's a big part of this movement, is disenfranchised and disadvantaged communities, those who are most, you know, impacted, you know, poor communities, are those who face the pollution. Those are often those who are in kind of the line of fire. And that's a big part of, in New York State, we just passed groundbreaking climate legislation, the Climate Leadership Communities Protection Act. And one part of that legislation is that 35 to 40% of the solutions involved and the actions taken by the state need to directly impact and include those communities, including clean jobs, you know. So this is an opportunity, obviously, to save our lives, to save the planet. I mean, you know, I agree, the planet's going to be here, so it's really, we're saving our lives, you know, what's at stake here. But, you know, also being able just to turn around the way we do business, you know, talk about system change and revolution, 100%. That's really what this is all about. We need to live completely differently. Historically, that doesn't happen very easily, but, you know, revolution can happen. A tipping point in consciousness can happen. I really believe in critical mass. Hey, you know, in New York State, it took us 5 years to ban fracking. I was involved when not a lot of people knew about fracking the Onondaga Nation, and Oren was involved in the early years of that campaign and calling for a ban on fracking. And I will tell you, people told us, people told me, told us every day, you are not going to beat the gas industry. There's no way you're going to beat the gas industry. We have to regulate this industry because a ban is never going to happen. They have too much money and too much power. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Because we organized, we knocked on doors. A lot of us did this work, you know, just as volunteers, living off of savings and debt. You know, I lived in a compound. People were sleeping on the floor. We were literally, you know, going, knocking on doors across the state, building a movement, getting elected officials involved, getting, you know, schools and teachers, you know. And so that's what I'm saying. It's going to take that type of social movement. It's going to take boots on the ground, like Oren was saying. It's going to take knocking on doors. It's going to take educating everybody, your family, talking to your family members, talking to your friends. That's really going to make this happen. But I, you know, I'm an optimist. I agree that it's even. But yeah, you know, just to bring it back, and it's going to involve everybody, you know, not just the same old, you know, group of people.
We need to wrap up here in just a minute, but let's see. I mean, what are each of your best points of optimism or area that can make a difference?
You know, in an interesting way, this may sound more pessimistic than it actually is, but I've found a lot of energy for myself by kind of foreclosing on futurity in a way. That is, I believe in presentness, and I believe in acting with present responsibility. And I think we need to, at the same time that we're throwing our energy into the types of advocacy that you're talking about, Renee, I do think we have to start talking about resiliency, creating regenerative economies. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like I don't want to wait. I don't want to wait for the federal government. I don't want to wait for even the state government. I just want to start doing it and start linking in a very community-oriented way. Mm-hmm. And so to that end, we're starting a Center for Cultural Ecology in Hudson, New York. And it's the first year is about listening. You're talking about how to bring these voices in. For me, as a white male, that's going to start with listening for a while, mm-hmm. and just hearing what other people are doing and trying to integrate that into some kind of action plan that includes financing, that includes connecting the agricultural economy to the creative economies, thinking that way, thinking about being here now, thinking about how we can build resiliency right now.
Well, and those things could be value-related, mm-hmm. but also start to shift norms.
Exactly. Yeah. It's about building culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ken?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think along with Ed in Casnovia, where I live, we're actually starting, there's a solar project that's going to power a lot of the village, 100 homes apparently, and a lot of the vehicles. And I just heard about this just the other day. And I went, really? Wow, that's exciting. Okay, good. I'm like, okay, what can I do? You know, how can I be a part of that in my own community? Mm-hmm. And the folks that may not vote the way I vote that are my neighbors, we still share beers once in a while, like understanding each other and respecting each other as humans, maybe not, you know, ideologically. But I think it's really valuable. And then what can I do as a teacher? I'm evolving my curriculum in different classes to include conversations around the climate crisis, whether it's producing nonfiction pieces or music videos or posters or interactive pieces, working with the climate desk, you know, in ways something I can do. So I've been depressed for a while once I realized the gravity of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just now coming out of the fog and saying, okay, you know, none of us live forever. Impermanence is a thing, ironically. And so let's get to work. I think it's there's hope in
getting
one
to
another.
Work. Yeah, getting to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the indigenous people, we've got together been working with Nature Conservancy. They're a powerful group. They're 65 countries. And we convinced them that, you know, sequestering land is not good enough now because it's going to be burning up or being flooded. Got to do something active. So they did. We said, what's a point of interest? Let's pick a point in Pebble, a copper gold mine in Alaska that Trump is trying to reopen and that President Obama had sequestered and put some hard levies against it. So they're after opening all these copper mines. They need copper around the world. And so we said, okay, let's talk about the pebble. And so Nature Conservancy has their lawyers up there right now. And we're going to organize the native people there because that's right at the mouth of a river with the biggest salmon run in Alaska. Mm. And they're going to build a mine there. They're going to kill that. They don't care. Mm. So we're going after the corporations. We are the problem. We're going right after them as a start. And once we organize and get our groups together, we'll pinpoint another one. They can turn around fast. One thing about business is they operate on a razor's edge. Mm-hmm. They can change their minds. They can do it, which they do. So
just given the right motivation and the right threat. You're in the threat.
The right threat. Exactly. Yeah. You gotta bring them down. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to do. We're focused on a pebble mine right up there in Alaska. Everybody look at it. Fishermen up there, everybody's against it. It's a good place to start. Mm. Nail them.
Mm. I'm with you.
And Renee, like one idea of optimism?
Hope, optimism.
Place, place for
that's my
hope.
That's
hope
my favorite
for,
word.
Hope for change.
I mean, there's so much hope and optimism. I mean, I've just seen more people involved in the climate movement, in the environmental movement here in New York State and across the country and around the world than I've ever seen before. I mean, we all see it, you know, just look at the youth movement that's happening. We are passing stronger legislation across the country right now. States are competing, you know, to who has the strongest legislation to get to renewable energy quicker, to get to energy efficiency quicker, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions faster. Obviously, our new piece of legislation is competing with California to be, you know, the strongest legislation in the country. You know, we're looking to go 70% renewable energy by 2030 in New York State and an 85% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2050. More people are going solar, either community solar or on their roofs than ever before. We have more funding and programs than ever before in New York State to install a geothermal or air source heat pump or to make your home more energy efficient or to get into an electric vehicle. I mean, the thing that I think people don't realize, there's tax credits, there's rebates, and that's what we're really moving quickly to let people know that we, you know, this is happening. You know, we have the legislation in place. We have the money in place. How do we just deploy it as quickly as possible? And then we have to ramp it up. We have to go even faster than we're already going. We have to set higher standards than we're already setting. And we need mandates. Mm-hmm. It can't just be left to the individuals, right? We need to definitely continue to push back the fossil fuel industry, to shut these industries down, and, you know, shut dirty energy down and stop it at like a big movement, you know, level. But we also need mandates to turn over to clean energy and not just leave it up to individual choice to make that happen. All new buildings, you know, need to be clean and efficient, sustainable, moving forward. And, you know, I think we're working towards that. And it's going to be up to all of us to make that happen. We can't put it in the hands of one decision maker or group.
Well, we will certainly be doing more coverage around climate change, its impacts, and how people are engaging around it. So keep listening to 88.3 FM WAER and visit our webpage at WAER.org. I want to thank our guests today, Onondaga Nation Faith Keeper Orin Lyons. Thanks for coming. Climate activist Renee Vogelsang, SU Visual Communications Professor Ken Harper, and Transmedia Professor Ed Morris. Thanks all of you.
Thank you.
With WAER's Katie Zilkowski, I'm Chris Bolt. This is Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
We got to improve our infrastructure in cities for especially being able to have bike lanes that allow people to get around easily to reduce traffic congestion and emissions from fossil fuel burning cars.
Weekdays starting at 5 a.m. on 88.3 FM WAER.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Zilkowski. Climate change is expected to bring big changes to how we grow the food we eat. And in New York, agriculture is a big part of the economy, bringing in nearly $4.5 billion to the state annually. But with threats of hotter summers, more insects and pests, and a greater risk for drought, the issues of agriculture and climate change are inarguably intertwined. Now, to address this, the state will invest nearly $10 million in agricultural innovation over the next 3 years through a competition called Grow New York. The initiative focuses on the state's central, Finger Lakes, and southern tier regions with a goal of positioning these areas of New York as leaders as we become forced to adapt to the changing climate. The inaugural summit took place in Rochester earlier this month, filled with panels, business pitches, and exhibits, all of them working directly or indirectly to create a more sustainable food system in New York.
By shaking the jar, you can actually mix the contents completely inside and eat out of the jar. You could also dump it on a plate, whatever your preference. But when you're done, we ask that you bring that jar back to us because we found a better use for it. Every jar that's returned to us, we wash, reuse, put it back into our process, and help to feed someone in need. And this was an aspect that we realized was ignored by every single one of our competitors. And by making it easy, we've achieved the highest rate of post-consumer packaging return at 93% here in the U.S.
We are part of that entire, you know, meal delivery category that has been associated with a lot of excess waste, right? We're proud to say that we are the lowest plastic footprint out there and one of the lowest packaging footprints out there. And as we continue to evolve the business, we will be working with a lot of the recycling companies. And in addition to that, we'll be working with a couple of companies to help us innovate our packaging away from being just less plastic to being no plastic.
Also, all of our materials in the box are either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, except for the food grade bags, which are BPA and phthalate free, which for food grade purposes cannot be recycled as is.
And this is why we're seeing a lot more plastic packaging and a lot of these solutions. So when we talk about plastic packaging, so retailers are now resorting to plastic wrapping their produce just to put a barcode on it. And this is about getting it through the checkout faster. We recently looked at two retailers in Europe, and they produce over 800,000 tons of plastic waste just for this. So that's not even including the little stickers they put on for identification. So is there a better solution? Well, at Toledo, we've developed a camera and software solution that automatically identifies the produce at the checkout so you or the cashier don't have to. It's based on a patented AI software, it's incredibly fast, and it's accurate.
These plans for sustainability from companies like Toledo, Real Eats America, and Simply Good Jars were not coincidental. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul says they were necessary.
Well, part of the criteria was to talk about sustainable practices and clean energy operations. So that was part of the genesis of this, not just continue the way we've always been, but help us rethink food yield, innovation, production, processing in a way that is good for our environment. That is the requirement.
For her, Grow New York is a way to show the connection between those two and find solutions to the problems. And the Lieutenant Governor is not alone in her thinking. The issue of climate was present throughout the summit. Daniel Cross from Love Beats says climate impacts reach beyond the soil.
We have some significant challenges globally, whether that's climate change, which means probably people need to move, and the way we grow things and move fresh food probably needs to be different. We have problems with packaging, where we're very good at polluting our environment, and that has impacts on other areas of the world, as well as the areas where the pollution originates from.
So these conversations must include farmers, but now they're also speaking with members of transport, distribution, and packaging to make the environmental impact of food minimal and sustainable. RIT's Daniel Johnson says designing lightweight packaging is essential to doing that.
You can address a huge percentage of the Northeast market in a day truck drive. You've got a great market to get to. And a big part of sustainability is the transportation carbon, essentially, right? And so going along with that, you'd like your product to be essentially light and travel really, really efficiently. And so the technology that goes into that is a big part of it. So overall, we're in a good spot from a distribution standpoint, but we all need to continue to focus on packaging and make sure that we do it as best we can. And that the trade-offs that are in front of us, we're making the best choices we can at this point.
Grow New York wrapped by awarding a total of $3 million to 7 of its 18 finalists. The winners covered issues such as sourcing from local farms, reducing packaging waste, and reducing or converting food waste. These startups are few of many in the state, and government officials want to capture their energy. The hope is agriculture will be one way for New York to lead in innovation and find solutions to climate issues. WAER will continue to cover the impact of agriculture on New York State in an upcoming series. I'm Katie Zolkowski. This is Syracuse Speaks.
This has been Syracuse Speaks. If you missed any portion of today's conversation or want to share it or hear it again, it will be posted on our website, waer.org. You can also find other Syracuse Speaks content there on demand from past broadcasts. Syracuse Speaks is a production of WAER Public Media.